I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Utah's best athletes count on flexibility, speed, strength.
And the Jazz pick up their 22nd assist.
So they count on University of Utah Health.
Real Salt Lake puts this game away.
And so can you. Leading doctors, a world-class environment, award-winning innovation, care to be great.
14 unanswered by the Utes.
University of Utah Health, caring for Utah's best and yours. Schedule your appointment now at uofuhealth.org/care to be great.
Utah, USC. The Utes battle the Trojans for a chance to play in back-to-back Rose Bowls. Pac-12 championship game coverage on The Zone is presented by UCCU. Love where you bang, right here on 97.5, the KSL Sports Zone.
Hans and Scotty, 97.5, the KSL Sports Zone. Hope you're all well. One of the best to cover the Pac-12 joins us now. John Canzano, kind enough to carve out a few moments for us. You can get to his website at johncanzano.com. Also on the radio statewide throughout the state of Oregon. John, how are you?
Hey, John.
Doing well. Exciting week. I'm interested to see what Utah looks like. And when I say that, I mean I'm interested to see what Cam Rising looks like. You know, can he regain that form that he had in the middle of the season?
So, Hans and I have had this argument, and I want to get your thoughts on it, because you have the pulse of the Pac-12. Obviously, there's financial ramifications of USC going to the college football playoff that benefits everybody in the Pac-12. However, having your conference champion, the team that gets you back in the college football playoff, already announcing that they want to leave and that they will be taking off to the Big Ten, is the rest of the Pac-12 USC fans this weekend for the financial gain, or are they kind of leaning Utah because they don't necessarily want to be represented by somebody who's leaving them for a better-looking girlfriend?
I think there's a lot of division. I mean, I know I've talked to people who say, hey, the money's great, and everybody gets to split that revenue, and the silver lining of USC going to the playoff is that the Pac-12 can always say that USC didn't need to go to the Big Ten to get to the playoffs, that there was a path through the Pac-12, so shame on them for leaving. So I think there's a faction of people who, you know, the athletic directors in particular, who would just love to have the extra $500,000 that they'll all get if the Trojans make the playoff. But there's some fans out there that you know, the last team they wanted to see make the playoff from the Pac-12 was USC. Like, even UCLA, you could say, well, they just went because USC was already going to the Big Ten, and there's a chance they may come back. You know, I think you could rationalize that. So I think if Utah gets ahead in this game, it'll be a little bit like Rocky Balboa in the early Rocky movies, with Pac-12 fans, you know, who at the beginning of the game may have gone, well, it's good for the conference to get USC in there, switching sides and chanting Rocky by the end of this thing.
If you could change, John, help us understand the scenarios. By the way, you see it. With a USC win, it means what? As far as bowl appearances, and a Utah win, it means what for both of those programs?
I think it's pretty simple. I think that, you know, Utah winning this game puts Utah in the Rose Bowl. USC winning this game likely puts Washington in the Rose Bowl. And I don't think Utah fans are going to be happy to hear that. But I think the way that the College Football Playoff Committee ranked the teams, they put Utah and Washington right there back to back. I think it'll be a really interesting decision for the Rose Bowl. I don't think it's necessarily fair, because if you think about it, you know, Utah is playing this game because they earned the right to get to the playoff or to get to the championship, and now they have something to lose if they lose the game. And Washington can just sit back and let a Rose Bowl potentially fall into their lap. And I think the same could be said of USC sitting in the four spot in the playoff. And I think there's going to be a lot of people questioning what should have happened or what should happen. Should these championship games be discounted by the committee? Should they be discounted by the bowl games? But I think it's going to be really hard for the Rose Bowl if there's a 10-win Washington team sitting there. Utah went to the Rose Bowl a year ago. Rose Bowl has that cluster provision in their contract where they can pick the matchup that they like. They generally go with the rankings, but it feels to me like it's pretty simple. It's you know, USC to the title game and probably Washington in the Rose Bowl, and unless Utah wins this game. And then I think you have a scenario where Utah goes to the Rose Bowl and USC becomes a pretty attractive candidate for one of the other New Year's Six bowl games, and the Pac-12 could have two teams playing in those games.
That's my follow-up question was, if USC does lose, where do they end up? And you feel like it would probably be another New Year's Six game.
Yeah, I think their ranking, it's, I think they're going to remain high enough in the rankings. And look, we've seen the committee, selection committee, say before that they don't place as much emphasis on the championship game losses as they do the regular season stuff or getting to the championship game. So I think even if USC falls out of the top four, I would not expect them to free fall in this thing. And I think, you know, if I'm the committee, and I think they did that by putting Utah, you know, in front of Washington in the rankings, I think the committee was trying to signal that, hey, even if USC loses this neutral site game, you still put them in a New Year's Six game.
John Canzano, kind enough to join us right here on 97.5, the KSL Sports Zone. All right, so when you look at this game, obviously there is so much on the line for USC and obviously so much on the line for Utah. How do you see this one playing out after Utah had that dramatic win, albeit at home, in a pretty rowdy Rice-Eccles Stadium? Now it's a little bit more of a neutral site, although Utah fans claim that they're going to try to gobble up every available ticket. But how do you think a neutral site affects this game?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I was there October 15th. I came out to see that game in person. I wanted to see it with my eyes because I thought at the time these were the two best teams. And the performance in the second half in particular by Utah was remarkable. And when you look at sort of the quarter-by-quarter stats or even the drive chart of that game, I've spent a lot of time after that game looking at the drive chart because people will remember USC came out on their first three drives and scored 21 points. They made it look pretty easy. They went 75 yards, 80 yards, 69 yards. Didn't look difficult. Two of those drives were under 2 minutes. I mean, they just went right down the field. And I thought, gosh, Utah's got to find an answer. But I do think Utah found an answer about midway in the second quarter. Andy Ludwig and that offense figured something out. And if you look at the drive chart, the last six drives of that game, Utah had five touchdowns on six drives. The only drive they didn't score on in the third quarter was that fumble inside the five-yard line that was unfortunate after a 72-yard drive. So they would have been 6-for-6 on touchdowns. And so I'm kind of wondering, did Andy Ludwig figure something out about the USC defense that he still can use in this game? Because teams change, players get hurt, teams evolve. Lincoln Riley's busy this week saying that was a different game, this is a different team. He may be right. But if you're a Utah fan trying to construct a way that you win this game, I think you have to start with what happened at about the 5-minute mark of the second quarter. And that's where Utah started to dominate this game, and really, they won the game 35-21 from that point. And so I think 36-21 with a two-point conversion. But I think it's really interesting to look at that and then try to figure out how healthy Cam Rising is, because neutral field, home field, away game, you know, I saw Cam Rising at Oregon just a couple weeks ago. He didn't look good, you know, and Utah, because he wasn't right, became an easier out for an Oregon team that had been up and down all year. So you need Cam Rising right. You need your receivers to hurt USC outside the hashes. You need to be able to run the ball. But I'm just leaning into the idea that did Andy Ludwig figure something out that they can use moving forward?
So, John, I've been looking through the USC schedule throughout the year and trying to identify their best win. Their best win might be last week against Notre Dame. You could maybe argue it was against UCLA, but they've got that Utah loss. I'm trying to figure out just how good USC really is, because if USC does get to that college football playoff, they probably match up against Georgia, and that didn't go real well for Oregon. It looked bad for the Pac-12, and it looked really bad for Oregon. So in your assessment, when you look at the best wins that USC has, throw in the one loss that they've got, how good do you really think USC is?
I think their best win, I was there at Reser Stadium in Corvallis when they beat Oregon State 17-14. Oregon State locked them down, made Caleb Williams very uncomfortable. You know, Morgan Scally is watching that tape trying to figure out what Oregon State did to disrupt Caleb Williams and USC and hold them. Really, they had 7 points in that game until the fourth quarter and really gave them fits. And so I talked to Trent Bray, the defensive coordinator at Oregon State yesterday, and he said he felt like Michael Penix Jr. gave them a tougher matchup than Caleb Williams. So I think that's interesting to note that. The teams that USC has struggled against are very balanced offensive teams. When Utah was able to run the ball, use, you know, the tight end, Dalton Kincaid, Cam Rising, you know, on some design runs, and just freelancing himself, that's where, in the second half of that game, where USC started to struggle a little bit. And so, you know, I don't think Notre Dame is very good, guys. Stanford beat Notre Dame. Cal should have beat Notre Dame. I covered Notre Dame as a beat reporter. There's a lot of hype around that program. I think they're generally overrated in most years. When you look at their ranking, I think people want them to be good. They like the brand of Notre Dame. But I'm not putting too much into that win last week. I thought the more impressive showing was USC's victory at Corvallis, tough place to win, and then beating UCLA. USC can score. They can score on almost anybody. But, you know, this game's going to come down to, will Utah take care of the ball? No turnovers. You cannot turn the ball over against USC if you want to beat them. Oregon State did it 4 times and lost that game. And then the other thing is Cam Rising's health. Keep an eye on that. And also, I'm looking for Morgan Scalley and the Utah defense to create a 3-and-out. They did not do that on October 15th. There were no 3-and-outs in that game for USC's offense.
John Canzano with us, 97.5, the EKSL Sports Zone. That USC defense, as great as that offense has been, the defense has had some moments, and they showed flashes against Notre Dame. But do you have any faith in that USC defense, not only in this game, but let's say they get past Utah, but going into the college football playoff?
No, Georgia's going to score 100 points on them. I mean, they're not going to stop them. And I think that's the thing, you know, like Utah fans have got to lean into. Like all year long we've watched USC. They ended up better than I thought they would be. I thought they were about an 8 or 9 win team all along. I was like, why are we anointing them the champion, you know, at the beginning of the year? Why are we, you know, let them prove it. They've gone out and, you know, they have not turned the ball over. They're very opportunistic on defense. They've created problems for people. But if in this game, you know, Utah, I think, will move the ball. I think they will score on USC. It's just a matter of can they stop USC. And in a championship, tournament, 4-team tournament, Georgia's going to stop USC. Georgia physically at the point of attack. I saw that Oregon-Georgia game up close. You guys saw it on TV. You know, Georgia's tight end is like 6'7", 270. Like, you know, they're not playing. This is another level of football, and I think Georgia's going to win the tournament anyway. But I kind of want to see, like, if USC makes the playoff, I'd like to see him as the 4 seed, because I'd like to see if Caleb Williams and USC can score on Georgia, because I don't give him more than about 24 points in that game at most.
John, are you of the belief that if David Shaw doesn't step down, he's still the head coach at Stanford, or were they ready to move on?
Yeah, I think he would have still been the coach. I think they would have asked him to be change his coordinators and do some of those things they do to respected coaches who aren't performing. I think Stanford's well aware that they cannot compete in this era with the transfer portal unless they're going to relax some academic standards in football. They had one transfer, and it was somebody who transferred in to get an MBA. You know, they're not like Arizona. Arizona had 21 transfers. You can't get Michael Penix Jr. to Stanford. You can't get Caleb Williams to Stanford. You can't get Bo Nix to Stanford or Cam Rising even into Stanford. You just can't do that with their academic standards. And so I think the campus as a whole either has to acknowledge, hey, we're not going to be as competitive in this world. We're going to have to play differently. Or they're going to have to relax the standards because, you know, David Shaw was a guy who, you look at his record, you know, 10 win, 10 win, 10 win, you know, Rose Bowl, and then all of a sudden he can't coach? No, he couldn't recruit. And, you know, he's going 3-9 in an era where Jed Fish is getting 21 new players and Arizona State had 20 new players that, like, you know, we all look around. The success is with those who can get a transfer quarterback and fill gaps.
How appealing is that job? I mean, obviously, there's a scarce amount of them, so there won't be hurting for people that want that job, but is that an appealing job given the landscape of college football right now?
Yeah, I don't think it is. I think it's really risky. And so, you know, I know Bernard Meir, the athletic director there, he has a reputation of being very collaborative, and so I won't be surprised if he leans into Richard Sherman and Andrew Luck and other, you know, notable alumni, John Elway, and says, all right, look, how do we play this game? How do we play the name, image, likeness game? How do we play the transfer portal game differently at Stanford? Because it's not enough right now that at Stanford and Cal, those two schools in particular, that you can go there and you can get a great academic education. You know, that appeals to a lot of people, and maybe they change the style of play that they play, and you know, maybe they change, go away from a quarterback-centric offense and go to the wishbone or something. I don't know. But you can't do what other people are doing right now. So I think the first thing is going to be a lot of collaboration. The second thing will be Stanford, you know, really doing some soul searching and asking the academic side of the campus, hey, is it okay to relax the standards when it comes to football only and the transfer portal? Because if you can do that, I think you can get quarterbacks and receivers and running backs to come to Stanford.
Can somebody win at Colorado, John?
It's risky. Again, that's a risky job. If you look at the track record, that's why I think the Deion Sanders thing was interesting, because, you know, Rick George, the AD there, is a smart guy. He's worked for the Texas Rangers, Major League Baseball, golf tournaments, golf tours. He knows what he's doing. But the fact that it got out that they offered Deion Sanders the job, Deion Sanders not taking that job. He's smarter than that. He knows it's a risky thing for him. He goes there and loses, and all of a sudden the shine's off him. Deion could be the next coach at Florida State when that job opens up. So I think Deion's only going to make a smart move. And Colorado is a 50-50 proposition. I mean, you're not even Arizona State at Colorado. You can win there, but I think they're probably more inclined to do what Arizona State did and go with somebody younger, somebody who's got ties to the university. Keep an eye on Brian Lindgren, the offensive coordinator at Oregon State. You know, he's got ties to Colorado. But I think beyond Deion, the message we're getting from Colorado is it has to be a recruiting hire, transfer portal hire. Deion, much in the mold of Deion Sanders. So maybe a Dan Lanning-like hire, or, you know, somebody like that that's coming from the SEC that wants a job. But you're not going to get an established coach who's a veteran coach who's going to take that job unless it's their last resort.
You do a lot of radio in Oregon. I got to imagine it's been when Oregon blows a 21-point lead in the third quarter and loses to a rival in Oregon State. No lack of storylines coming out of that game in that state, I'm sure.
Brutal. Just a brutal performance by Oregon. I mean, they had to do so much wrong to lose that game. But Oregon State, you know, I don't know if people in your listening area know how that unfolded. Oregon State ran 15 plays in the fourth quarter. They scored 21 points. All 15 plays were running plays. They never threw the ball, and they overcame a 21-point deficit and won the game. And everyone in the stadium knew they were running, and they were getting 7-plus yards a pop in the run game. But beyond that, Oregon had a punt blocked in the game. They had another occasion where they were punting from their own goal line, and the punter dropped the ball at the one-yard line and then just fell on it. And Oregon State took over and punched it in. And they had another ensuing kickoff where Oregon State kicked off. The ball landed at the one-yard line and bounced straight up in the air instead of going into the end zone. All of a sudden, the Oregon kick returner realized he better take the ball, and he just got buried inside the 10. And then Dan Lanning, on the ensuing offensive possession, goes for it on 4th-and-1 from his own 28-yard line, doesn't get it because Bo Nix, who's got a bad ankle, is trying to run the ball. It was a debacle.
How are we doing on TV negotiations with the Pac-12, John?
Yeah, I think they're going to talk tomorrow. George Kliavkov, the commissioner, is going to talk tomorrow, but I don't think he's going to have any news on media rights. I think, you know, they probably know what the valuation is. I think they're waiting to see what the UC Regents do with UCLA before that comes out. So I'm going to say December 14th, we're going to get news on UCLA, and then sometimes between the 14th and Christmas, we'll probably get a leak of some kind that says, hey, they got a deal. I expect Amazon to be involved. I think ESPN is going to be involved. And keep an eye on the possibility of some crossover non-conference games with the ACC members. I think that is on the table. I think it's a moneymaker for the conference. They could take the big matchups like Utah, Clemson, Oregon, Miami, and you play those games in Vegas or L.A. at SoFi Stadium. And, you know, much in the same way that Oregon played Georgia in that Chick-fil-A kickoff classic, you could create, you know, a windfall of $3 or $4 million for the participants.
You mentioned that meeting with the Board of Regents that got pushed back to middle of December. Is that just, I mean, you know, politicians like to grandstand. Is there a lot of grandstanding going on there? And the end of it, they'll just say, well, there's nothing we can do, and off they go to the Big Ten. Does Cal get a little bit of money out of this, or do they actually, is there actually a concern that they might shut down UCLA's move to the Big Ten?
Yeah, I think UCLA is a little more worried now than they were months ago. I think, you know, I talked to some people in the UCLA community that are decision makers, and they initially were like, it's 99% we're going. Then I heard 98%. Now I'm hearing 95%. You know, so I think they're softening up a little bit, but I think this delay is interesting. I initially thought, you know, the Regents have a lot on their plate, and I was looking at the rest of the agenda items, and it's serious stuff. It's not football. It's student safety. It's student housing. They're dealing with issues that are far more serious than college football. But I also think the Regents, you know, what they ultimately would like is they would like UCLA to come to their senses, and they'd like UCLA to go, hey, you know what? There was more money in this Pac-12 media rights deal than we originally anticipated. We're leaving for $62.5 million. It's going to cost us like $28 million to travel and take care of our students, so we're giving away a huge chunk of that. And if the Pac-12 can present a number to them between now and the 14th of December that, you know, makes it palatable for them to stay in the conference, I think that's a win for the Regents, because then they don't have to come in, they don't have to penalize anybody, they don't have to look like the bad guys. So I actually think this delay is designed to allow UCLA to kind of absorb the landscape, see what's at stake, and ask themselves, do you really want to put your athletes on the road to Rutgers and Northwestern and all these other sports besides football on a regular basis? And, you know, the Pac-12, I do think, probably has put some numbers in front of UCLA that we haven't seen. You know, I am told that they asked ESPN, Fox, Amazon, and others for valuations on the media rights that included UCLA, not USC, but included UCLA. So I know they have those numbers. So I think they're going to put the numbers in front of UCLA, probably are doing that now, and they're going to let UCLA kind of mull it over. But if UCLA decides to go, I do expect that there's going to be a penalty, and then Cal will get a check.
Wow. Hey, really quick before we let you go, I just saw the tweet that you sent out a little bit earlier. The Pac-12 would not tell you who the officiating crew is for the Utah-USC game? Is that right?
No, they won't tell me. And it's funny. I've never asked for a championship game before, so I don't know if this is unusual or not. They would not give me the names of the officials. But they did tell me that, you know, it's the highest graded officials at every position, except no official can go to the championship game 2 years in a row, and it can't be a first-year official, which I think is ridiculous, because now they're treating it like a reward for the officials at the end of the year instead of just putting the best damn officials on the field, which is what Utah and USC deserve. So I'm really curious to see who's going to show up. We'll probably get the names in front of kickoff, but I also want to ask George Kliavkov, the commissioner, tomorrow, you know, what is he going to do to fix this? Because at the very least, they have a bad perception problem. But more likely, look, the officiating in the Pac-12 just isn't on par with other Power 5 conferences. They have no feeder system. The officials are complaining to me privately, saying, you know, I see them and I talk with them and they say, hey, we don't have a feeder system. We're taking officials from Conference USA that aren't trained. And, you know, I'm working with new crew every weekend. And there's a real synergy issue that we see every Saturday play itself out. So I don't want bad calls in this title game. We don't want bad calls to decide the title game. We want to be talking about something else, but the Pac-12 has to let us do that.
John, we could keep you all hour. We appreciate it. We've probably kept you too long anyway, but thanks for your time. Great stuff, and I look forward to catching up with you again here in the near future.
A lot of fun, John.
Take
thanks.
Care. Yeah, I'll be there in Vegas. I'll be excited to see, you know, is Cam Rising healthy? If he is, I think Utah's got a puncher's chance to win this game.
85%? How about that? He's not 100, that's for sure.
Is he better than what he was against Oregon? Against Oregon, he couldn't move. He couldn't plant. Like I noticed against Oregon, he had a brace on. I'd not seen him with a brace on for several weeks. Keep an eye on that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thanks, John.
Take care.
Go to johnconzano.com. You can also follow him on Twitter. Also a great radio host in the Oregon area as well.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.